Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Sarcini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Anafuwakin.
This week, more updates in the Edward Snowden NSA case, Instagram adds video, the FAA relaxes rules on gadgets during travel, Barnes & Noble quits making Nooks, is Pandora ripping artists off, and much more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and the subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. And, of course, join us on facebook.com/thedrilldown and twitter.com/thedrilldown. Now, before we get into the headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And, Dwayne, last week you wanted to talk about the Pebble, and we decided to wait on that for a week because we had so much to talk about, and we did get into the Ouya, which we'll talk about a little bit later as well. But for this week, let's talk about the Pebble, because now you've had time to play with the Pebble, and I have had time to play with the Pebble after having had two previous defective Pebbles that I've had to send back to Pebble and have them send me new ones. This third one I finally got. It's finally working as advertised, and I've had enough time to actually get the whole experience of it down. So what do you think about your Pebble?
Overall, I like it. I waited until the orange one came out. I did the Kickstarter that said you're going to get the special color that people vote on.
Yeah.
It actually works really well with me. So I got it, last week or the week before. And I really, really like it. So when it comes to the app ecosystem, there are not a ton of apps out there for the Pebble. There's a whole bunch of watch faces and right. So on. But it's not like one of those things where like, yeah, I got like 300 apps already, that kind of thing. What it does do that I do like is that it notifies me quickly of things that I would not have necessarily felt because my phone isn't on me, or it's in a pocket yet I can't feel it because I'm running or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I really like the fact that I can set an alarm on it, and I will always know that alarm's going to go off.
Yeah.
And I tend to use my phone in a dock system or use it for like AirPlay, mm-hmm. to play music or podcasts, and like Amazon Cloud Player or like the podcast app are kind of my go-to apps. And when it comes to that, and I'll do that when I get home, I'll walk in the house, I'll just put on AirPlay and I'll like set it and forget it. And now if I'm cooking or I'm just like cleaning up or whatever, I can pause and play that stuff quickly from the phone, from the watch, and that's cool. I've also come to realize that wearing a watch, when it does stuff that you want it to do, and isn't just telling you the time, because like to me the whole thing about a watch is that I can look at my phone and get the time, get the date, no problem. Yeah. The idea that I can, get other information like the text messages come in my watch, a phone call comes in my watch, all these things, and the fact that I can change the faces whenever I feel like it. And that it's it looks pretty cool. I'm used to wearing a watch again. I also like the fact that it's not like a metal band because I never liked those.
Sure.
So that was a big problem for me. I have arthritis in my wrists, and metal bands always gave me a little bit of an issue. So this one, it sticks. It's really good. I was riding my. It was like bike to work day here in Colorado. I did that, and I kind of had it on basically every day. The battery life is incredible. So I don't have a lot to say about it negative, except for the following. I can't quite figure out how to set it so that it gets a buzz when I get emails from certain accounts. Like you hook it up to Bluetooth and then it says show notifications, fine. And then it only shows notifications that you have basically that are, with the exception of text messages, that are alerts or badges. in your iOS settings.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't get nuanced enough to be like, I want my work account to buzz me on my wrist, but I don't need my Gmail account to buzz me on my wrist. And I just feel like it's kind of, the notification system isn't as robust. And I think that's more of an iOS problem than a Pebble problem.
Yeah.
But it's not reliable when it comes to things like email. Every once in a while, it'll ask me to reset it on the phone. I do that. It's not a problem. I haven't experienced a crazy amount of dead battery because of the Bluetooth connection between my Pebble and my phone. I really think that here, Bluetooth low power is doing its job.
I have to say that I have, not dead battery, but I've noticed a significant drop in my battery life since wearing my Pebble. I think the Bluetooth really does, the communication with the Bluetooth really does kind of suck up a lot.
See, I have not experienced great battery life in my iPhone 5 to begin with. My girlfriend's 4S is a lot more powerful on that front than my 5 has been.
Mm-hmm.
So now that Bluetooth's on all the time, I don't feel like I'm experiencing much less battery life. Now, granted, my car has Bluetooth as well. So the Bluetooth is always on, even if it's not connected to anything. So if it's searching for something, I actually feel like it's doing more work. But I don't know that for a fact. I have to look into like how the profiles work and everything. I do know that since I got a car that has Bluetooth built into it, I haven't experienced a crazy amount of battery drainage. And now that I have the Pebble, I haven't experienced any other crazy amount of battery drainage. I just know that my phone is like a 29 to 32 hour phone with light usage. And it used to be when I had a 4S and I had a 3GS before that, it used to be like a 48 hour phone, 50 hour phone, no problem. So granted, I have more apps that do more things than I did when I had the 4S or when I had the 3GS, right? Like I had more. I have more now. I do more things on the phone, but I don't think the Pebble has led to a meaningful decrease. I looked on the Pebble site. They're like, it should like decrease your battery by 5 to 10%. It probably does that, but I haven't experienced like a terrible, crazy situation.
How do you feel about the Pebble compared to some of the other solutions that don't necessarily, like I'm thinking of like the Fitbit or the Jawbone Up, or, you know, these are devices that also go on your wrists that also sort of help you manage your lifestyle, but aren't necessarily timepieces in and of themselves.
So the Jawbone Up is specifically designed to look like a piece of jewelry.
Yeah.
On a man, someone might say, oh, what's that? Because men don't wear jewelry that often. So be it. Jawbone Up has a lot of problems, though. It has never gotten a great review. The Fitbit, whatever the wrist version of the Fitbit is, that looks a little bit more technological. But frankly, I have a Fitbit Ultra, one of the earlier Fitbits. I wear it every day. I like the Fitbit ecosystem. I like how it works. I have an Aria. I have the scale. And I think it's interesting. What I would like is for Fitbit to do like Runkeeper and integrate with the Pebble. In fact, I think the Pebble already has an accelerometer and so on and so forth. It has light detection. It has all that stuff. So Runkeeper can use it. So I think there's the ability for limited Fitbit metrics to be taken with a Pebble watch. And it'd be nice if Fitbit could work with Pebble to get that done. One, it would extend Fitbit to those early adopters who've already got a Fitbit. So let's say you bought a Fitbit device and the Pebble is available and you have the Pebble, you know, you say, okay, Fitbit, I already gave you money for hardware, but I want to opt to use my package, my software on this Pebble device. There's that. And then they can limit it to the people who've spent the $50 a year on like Fitbit Premium, which gives you access to your API and all the other stuff like that. So I feel like there is a play for Fitbit to be on the pulse of what's new with Pebble. And I know that I'd probably prefer to wear just one thing. Now, does a wrist-based thing do the same job as a hip-based thing? I can't tell you. I don't know. I know that I like the. I'm used to the way my Fitbit tracks me. So I'm not sure how it would be if it didn't. If it was a wrist-based thing, I haven't used the Fitbit wrist-based device at all. So,
my usage of the Fitbit, I actually tend to In the past, before I got the Pebble, I used to actually spend a lot more time wearing it on my wrist with the sleep band, because I would use it usually during, you know, physical activities, sports, and things of that nature, and I just didn't want to clip it anywhere for fear that it falls in the grass or, you know, competitive things that I couldn't really stop to pick it up. So I think it worked really well, and I was very comfortable having it there. Now, at the time that I got my Pebble, you know, the Pebble now takes the spot of the wrist. I actually, for a second, tried putting the Pebble on my other wrist to see if this would work a little better, but having two wrist devices, not so much. Anyway, the Pebble itself, you know, now goes on my wrist, and for a unfortunately elongated period of time, I actually stopped carrying my Fitbit around. And
that is sacrilegious.
I know, it's so bad. But it was also because, you know, typically for my, I typically leverage my desktop computer to charge my devices, and unfortunately, it only has one, you know, USB slot on the front. It has several other types of slots on the top. But anyway, I leverage that to plug in, you know, both my webcam at times or charging my Pebble, and the Fitbit kind of took a back burner. Now, that being said, I've started carrying it in my pocket rather than wearing it on. As far as
which Fitbit do you have?
I have the original Fitbit.
The black and blue one, the Ultra?
Yep, black and blue.
Yeah, that's the one I have. And I wear that in my jeans, in my, like, the money pocket that is in the jeans.
Yeah, that's a good spot. Mine is a little cracked because I used to clip it onto my pants, and I feel like it kept expanding it / bending the plastic.
Yeah, I've never clipped it before. But yeah, so I feel like that's why I keep my Fitbit, and I continue to use it, and that's fine. But I definitely haven't experienced, I feel like I wear a lot of things now. Now that I have the Pebble and the Fitbit and all those other things like that. So
the part is just really awesome about the Pebble. I one of the saddest things for me is the times where I forget to charge my Pebble and it runs out of juice. This happened a couple of times. One was because I just didn't bring my cable with me and I was for, you know, over 7 days. And I still instantaneously look at my wrist to check the time, which is, it's awesome being able to check the time. Like, it's kind of funny that we talk about it now.
Yeah.
It's so awesome to be able to check the time on my wrist, even though that's been a thing for like 100 years.
But it's so disappointing when you have a blank screen that means nothing.
Yeah.
But I was actually showing someone else.
Does the Nike device tell time or give you the time? Nike's, I don't remember what their device is.
The Fuel Band.
Fuel Band. Doesn't the Fuel Band give you time?
It may. I don't know. I have a feeling it does. Mm. But I mean, all those things. The thing about the Fitbit that I like, and I have the Ultra, is that the Fitbit is attached to it's attached to a hub that is attached to a little computer that I have, and the hub is always there. So the minute I walk in my house, boom, it's gonna sync. And I like that functionality better because my girlfriend has the Fitbit One, and that's a Bluetooth connection, so she gets more updates. It's always updating, you know, every however long it's gonna update to her phone, and that's gonna go to the internet and do all its business. But I feel like her battery life is not my battery life. I have a straight 12, 13 days on my Fitbit Ultra in terms of battery life. And with my Pebble, since I've got it like 2 weeks ago, I guess not last Wednesday, but the Wednesday. Yeah, I haven't I've charged it maybe once. Not because it complained, but just because I'm like, gosh, I might as well charge it. So I have a little thing by my bed that charges things up. So I feel like it's a device that I'm not thinking about. The e-paper display is good. I went to the Wirecutter, which is, for anyone listening, the Wirecutter is sort of it's like a Metacritic for devices, technology, things you'd buy for your home or body or whatever. And they literally say, if you're going to get one of these, they all suck now, but if you're going to get one, get the Pebble. And I felt kind of gratified because I think the Pebble is a definitely early stage device, but it's a fun device to have. And, I continue to enjoy it. So,
All right. So let's get into some of these headlines now. First off, right off the bat, Last week, we during our What We're Playing With segment, we talked about the Ouya. Well, Ouya, the open source game console that became a massive hit on Kickstarter, has officially launched to the public this week, and already it's unavailable in a few online stores.
In the online store, Amazon.
Amazon, yep. It's also sold out at GameStop as well.
So. Yeah, I mean, guys, we're looking at a system that, yeah, people were like, oh, it's Android, so it's mobile technology. It's gonna be like obsolete in no time. Oh, it's you know, who knows who's making the games, yada yada yada.
Yeah,
I think where Pebble succeeds is in its philosophy about a game console. The PS4 is coming out. The PS3 is out right now. The Xbox 360 is out right now, and the Xbox One's coming out. Xbox One is going to be $500. PS4 is going to be $400, and you can get your hands on a PS4 for $300 and a good Xbox for around $300 as well. Those are the prices of game consoles. You can get a Wii for like $150, but I really think that we're going to say that the Wii's been sunset, so to speak, when it comes to the relevant technology right now. So the Ouya, its philosophy is, hey, we're going to cost $100. That's it. And we're not going to be a humongous set-top box. It's the size of an Apple TV with a little bit of height to it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the size of a hockey puck with a little bit of height to it, to give you an example. So the Ouya is a small device. It's not taking over the space under your television set. It's only $100. And the big crux is that you can try every single game for free. Every game has a trial version. And that's that's something you can do when you have downloadable games. It's not something you can do when you've got the disc situation, because when you have a disc, people need to buy that disc, and that disc is what they take home, and that costs $60.
Yeah.
So this situation is great. It does, you know, it mimics the mobile phones, except for the fact that a mobile phone, you tend to make the purchase, unless you get the free copy and then you get the pay copy. You are getting involved in this ecosystem wholesale with a mobile phone. You're like, okay, I've done this. Now I've got to go do this other thing. With Ouya, every game you get, the default is the free version, and if you want more, you'll pay for more. And that is a way to explore consoles. Now, you've got the hacking stuff. Well, not quite hacking, but you've got the sort of, let's call it Ouya Plus, where you can put the ROM in the back.
Right.
And you can,
have you, you know, tried you any of that, by the way?
I haven't really gotten into it. I've got to figure it all out, and I haven't had time, frankly. But even without having that functionality, that N64 emulation or whatever, I'm having a good time with it. And just the idea that I do have that functionality, uh-huh, that I can get a whole other console, an N64, on my Ouya, that's great. So the thing has a low footprint. It uses low power. The hardware is, as far as I can tell, quality hardware. These controllers are beautiful.
Yes.
The controllers are, you know, they're not super, like, snazzy looking, but they're solid in the hand.
Yep.
They've got the touchscreen in the middle. You know, they've really thought of things, and the ecosystem surrounding this is great. You know, developers are putting together these games. They do not run slowly. They run quite fast. And frankly, we all know that if the PS3 and the Xbox 360 can last for 7 years, and developers can optimize and optimize and optimize and optimize on the hardware, then Ouya could really have some legs. So, I don't mean to sound like a complete fanboy. I mean, I did back this Kickstarter, but I am going to say that there's something to the magic in the way they both presented this to the people and how they thought about how they wanted to change the console industry. Are they leaps and bounds? No, it's incremental change, but it's still a better way, I think, than this whole I got to buy the game for $60, have it for 2 weeks, and sell it for $30 situation, right? So, yeah. I don't know. I'm excited about where it's going to go. I am going to get that emulation set up. I just got to figure out whether it's legal or not, and that'll tell me whether I should get it set up. If Nintendo's got a problem with it, I'm
going to
go out and get an N64 because it's only like $20.
I think it's legal under the proviso that if you already own the physical ROMs, it's okay to substitute the physical ROMs with the virtual ROMs.
Oh, I don't know if that's the case. I do have a stack of N64 games in my house in Brooklyn. Yeah. I maybe got to go get those. I don't know. But
All right. Moving on to more news on the Edward Snowden front. So since we last spoke, which we had our big, you know, NSA eavesdropping devoted episode last week, federal prosecutors have filed a criminal complaint against Edward Snowden, the former NSA contractor who leaked the trove of documents about top secret surveillance programs. They've charged him with theft, unauthorized communication of national defense information, willful communication of classified communications intelligence information to an unauthorized person. And those last two charges are brought under the 1917 Espionage Act. And since then, he's left Hong Kong to seek asylum in Ecuador.
Wait, hold on.
Yes.
He's left Hong Kong.
Yes.
As far as the news says right now, the 5th, 6th of June.
Sure. He's not in Ecuador yet.
We don't know that he's going to Ecuador. There's some speculation that he's going to Ecuador. WikiLeaks has said he may be going to Ecuador, but there's just nothing there are no legs there. There's no real support for the fact that he's actually going to be in Ecuador. If he shows up there, that's great. But again, we don't know for sure where he's going. We do know that he is in Moscow's airport.
Mm-hmm.
And Moscow has said that Edward Snowden has not, you know, he hasn't done anything wrong to us. Well, we don't want to let him in the country because he doesn't have a passport. So, you know, he has a choice. He just has to get out of Moscow.
Yeah. It's a real sort of hot potato issue because, you know.
The American administration has come out and said, we want him. Putin, give him to us. Yeah. And Putin's like,
yeah.
Well, guys, he's in the airport. And he's in like an international zone in the airport.
Right.
So he hasn't left that zone. I haven't brought him into my country. He hasn't sought asylum here in Russia.
Right.
But the fact is, you know, we're Russia. We're not the U.S. We don't kowtow to the United States. And he's got a choice. And the fact is, aside from what Putin says, from Moscow, there are plenty of places he can fly. He can fly to Cuba. He can fly to Ecuador. He can fly to North Korea if he wants. But it's an interesting place. It's interesting the places that he has been. Because these places are not places that are known to be particularly friendly to the United States right now. China and the U.S. are kind of in their kind of business-focused Cold War. Yep. And their cold cyber war, which Edward Snowden has shown is a full and open-blown war. It's a full-blown war. It's not a question of China's attacking the U.S., Puyong China. According to Snowden's documents, the U.S. has been attacking China as well.
Yeah.
So he's laid that out. There's now a cold cyber war between the United States and China, brought to us by a man whose name has snow in it. So there's something there. now, there's also this idea that, you know, Russia wants to be on the world stage. I mean, it obviously is, but they're not the superpower they once were. And it's Putin's mission to bring them to those heights again. So he's not going to look weak in front of his people or look weak in front of the world. He is currently the only country, and I say he's the country because really, let's face it, he is. He's the guy running the only country that is against taking out Assad in Syria, which the U.S. is for. In fact, the U.S. statement was, we're not going to let Assad win in Syria. And Russia's like, well, I don't know. I just don't know. So what I'm saying is that we've got a situation where the U.S. is made to look like a fool, relatively toothless, because Snowden has chosen to go to these two countries that are big enough and strong enough to say no. What happens when he goes to an Ecuador? Ecuador has a extradition treaty with the United States, but political asylum is something that they have, you know, they give pause to.
Right.
And the actual things, the tactics, the reasons, the aspects that create a political asylum situation are not defined in international law or the treaties between Ecuador and the United States and many other countries. So Edward Snowden, who could, you know, ostensibly say, I am looking for asylum in your country, may be able to go to a place like Ecuador and live out the rest of his days.
In the airport.
Or probably unlikely, but I guess technically, yes, he could if he could afford to. But, I mean, as much as he is a man who has some means, he doesn't have means like that. So he needs to get where he needs to get, and then he needs to like leverage what he's done in order to get as much money as possible. Now, the United States has said through one body or another, whether I've heard senators say it or congresspeople say it or people from the White House say it, there's generally this feeling that like, if he is such a whistleblower, why did he run into the bosom of our enemies? Now, obviously, these are hardline people. Calling China and Russia our enemies is a hard line. But this is definitely something to think about. So I feel like Snowden is a man at large. I think the real question is not where in the world is Carmen Sandiego, but where in the world is Edward Snowden? And that's going to be what little geeks hear from their parents at night.
And at the same time, since all of this has been going down in since our last record, he's actually leaked a couple of other interesting revelations, one of which is the fact that amongst all those companies that have cooperated either willingly or unwillingly with the NSA, Skype was one of the first. They sort of predated most of the others with their own secret program called Project Chess. And that was to explore the legal and technical issues in making Skype calls readily available to intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies. Project Chess was small, limited to fewer than a dozen people inside Skype, and was developed as the company had sometimes contentious talks with the government over legal issues about 5 years ago in 2009. So interesting that Skype was one of the early adopters of the special relationship with the NSA. Makes me feel a little bit wary about this conversation we're having right now on Skype.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't. If you're the government, you're realizing that, yeah, you know, I could probably get phone records, but I can't get Skype records. It's a different paradigm. It's a phone, but it's not a phone. It's on the internet. Mm-hmm. How am I going to figure out who's doing what? And that's a place you go. You look at Skype's user base. It's a lot of people. It's very friendly toward international calling rates. So, I mean, Skype is, if I were the government, I would be concerned about, you know, the people that I consider to be bad guys using Skype as a tool. So there's a lot of sense to be made there. Why it was targeted early as opposed to Apple, which was targeted late, largely in part, I imagine, because iMessage had not been invented yet, and so people weren't communicating via Apple servers the way they were communicating over AT&T and Verizon servers.
Yeah. Another one of the revelations that Snowden made public this last week is that provisions in which data collected on U.S. persons under FISA must be destroyed, extensive steps that analysts must take to try and check the targets are outside the USA, and provisions that allow the NSA to keep data that could potentially contain details of U.S. persons for up to 5 years, retain and make use of inadvertently acquired domestic communications if they contain usable intelligence, information on criminal activity, threat of harm to people or property, are encrypted or believed to contain any information relevant to cybersecurity. Preserve foreign intelligence information contained within attorney-client communications. Access the content of communications gathered from U.S.-based machines or phone numbers in order to establish if targets are located in the U.S. for purpose of ceasing further surveillance. So he basically revealed the rules of the game for FISA and how they relate to spying on domestic citizens. So it was an interesting bit of revelation.
Yeah, it's really, you know, considering everything that's been released, it's really interesting to me. At a certain point, you wonder if there should be this much surprise from people.
Uh-huh.
I think even it might have been earlier this year or last year, Wired put out an article about the NSA spying and a lot of in-depth information contained within it. And I guess it's it is it's more to the forefront when someone actually comes out and states and actually has physical evidence that they can point to, as well as I think it's more for some people it's more mystical when you have, you know, a spy type character, someone running around and eluding the law, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah,
I mean, there's been some talk that, you know, this USA Today published details of what was possibly PRISM in the year 2006, and that Snowden wasn't delivering anything brand new. But what he was delivering was stuff that was detailed and confirmed such reports. And that's what a big problem is. Some of the new stuff he has delivered, people are saying isn't even true, that his information is wrong. So there's a lot of discrediting going on here where it comes like, is he a whistleblower or a spy? If he were a whistleblower, he would have been the first to release it, but he wasn't the first. Therefore, he's a spy because he's giving this information to our enemies. You know, there's a lot of talk like that. So it's going to continue to be a fruitful conversation, perhaps, in determining what he is. If he is, in fact, a whistleblower, and he is to be lauded for his bold action in the face of adversity in order to preserve democracy, or if he's simply someone who wanted to see his name in lights and, you know, enrich himself by blowing this cover. And the fact is, it does not look at all as if he's been enriching himself. He could have sent this information to the Chinese without giving it to the others, you know, his reporters, and made some money, some significant money. He could have maintained sending information out to the Chinese or some other. And indeed, there may be other people in his position or similar positions in the NSA, in the CIA, contractors or just regular, rank and file employees who are doing that, who are enriching themselves by passing along secrets to governments that are not in the interest of the United States. But he did go out and he exposed himself early and exposed this thing. So I think we have to continue to wonder about his status.
And the motives behind it.
Yeah.
Speaking of, as long as we're talking about computer laws here, here's a story that you linked, Dwayne, to me. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act is a sweeping internet regulation that criminalizes many forms of common internet use, with vagueness being its core flaw. As written, the CFAA makes it a federal crime to access a computer without authorization or in a way that exceeds authorization. But Congress never clearly described what that really means, so lying about one's age on Facebook or checking personal email on a work computer could violate this felony statute. This flaw in the CFAA allows the government to imprison Americans for a violation of a non-negotiable private agreement that is dictated by a corporation. In January, internet innovator and activist Aaron Swartz faced the possibility of severe punishment under the CFAA for what amounted to an act of civil disobedience. He attempted to make documents, many created with public funding, freely available to the public. Rather than face this fate, he decided to end his brief but brilliant life. Writing in Wired, California Democratic Representative Zoe Lofgren and Oregon Democratic Senator Ron Wyden propose Aaron's Law, a bipartisan legislation intended to reform the CFAA, safeguarding commonplace activity, online activity, from overbroad prosecution and overly harsh penalties, while ensuring that real harmful activity is discouraged and fully prosecuted. Their proposal addresses the fundamental problems of CFAA by 1. Establishing that mere breach of terms of service, employment agreements, or contracts are not automatic violations of CFAA. 2. Bringing back balance to the CFAA by eliminating a redundant provision of the law that can subject an individual to duplicate charges for the same CFAA violation, and 3. Bringing greater proportionality to CFAA penalties. As it's written and being interpreted right now, it's just too it's too vague and open to too much interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, this is a civil liberties issue. Another one for the scrutiny. We have to scrutinize. We have to ask Congress for more stringent rules. And Congress likes to do broad things. Why? Because every branch of government wants as much power as it can possibly have, and every sort of
constituent of a law, in this case, you know, copyright holders and other people, they want control of that too. I mean, in their world, we'd all kind of be using iPads that are as restricted as the one that Apple currently makes. So it's a little upsetting, but I think that there will be legislation will change to better reflect that, or it will not be enforceable. But the idea of carting up Americans, driving down the street and throwing them in the back of your truck because they've accessed a site because they typed in a wrong URL, they didn't have permission to get there, that's a little crazy. So the hawks will say, well, no one's doing anything wrong, they don't have to worry about it, but we all know that's nonsense.
All right, let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the Audible book that I would like to recommend this week is Under the Dome, a novel by Stephen King. On an entirely normal, beautiful fall day in Chester's Mill, Maine, the town is inexplicably and suddenly sealed off from the rest of the world by an invisible force field. Planes crash into it and fall from the sky in flaming wreckage. As the dome comes down on it, people running errands in the neighboring town are divided from their families, and cars explode on impact. No one can fathom what this barrier is, where it came from, and when or if it will go away. If this plot actually sounds familiar to you, it was also the plot of the Simpsons movie. So, Steve, and I think that the Simpsons movie may have predated Stephen King's the publication of Under the Dome. So, I don't know who was inspired by what. But in any case, I've read this novel. It's pretty good. It's a bit long in that Stephen King fashion that some of his stories tend to be overly long, but otherwise it's pretty engaging, and it's also the subject of a recent new series on CBS, series/miniseries. I think it's an open-ended series. If it does well, they're gonna create a second series out of it, a season out of it, but right now it's a 13-week open-ended miniseries. And so that book, or any of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, can be yours for free, plus a 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. If you don't like Audible's service, you can cancel the service, and you still get to keep Under the Dome. And it's great because going to that site, audibletrial.com/thedrilldown, helps our show out. So if you've never subscribed to Audible before, use that link, that URL, and help us out. All right, we're going to take a little break here, listen to some music, and when we return, will video give Instagram the bounce it needs against emerging competitor Vine? Take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Onofawakin. Instagram, the immensely popular photo sharing app that was acquired by Facebook in a $1 billion deal last year, is not just for photos anymore. At a press event at Facebook's Menlo Park headquarters, Instagram's co-founder and CEO Kevin Systrom debuted a new feature called simply Video on Instagram. This lets people create 15-second videos to share on the device. The feature includes simple editing capabilities as well as 13 new filters, which are specially created for video. This is a clear move that pits Facebook more firmly against Twitter, which acquired its own short-form video sharing app called Vine last year. In response to why Instagram chose the 15-second time frame as opposed to the 6-second videos offered by Vine, Systrom said that 15 seconds was an artistic choice and stressed that he doesn't necessarily say that one is better than the others. Now, since then, Instagram users have embraced the application's feature by uploading 5 million videos in the first 24 hours of the feature's availability.
There has been some backlash against it, though. Users have reported that their Instagram app crashes on the iPhone, that the
video, when it goes to be played, takes forever to download. And so the Instagram experience is diminished. And these are things that Instagram is going to no doubt work out. They're not going to give up on video. But it's clearly a response more than it is an innovation. And I'm kind of, I guess, you know, Instagram is the boutique Facebook when it comes to music. And it's not music, it's a video and pictures. So it's interesting to see that this is the move they're making, but not completely surprising. 15 seconds is just a bit long to put on Twitter. I feel like Twitter is focused on the 12-second kind of situation. So they make a big differentiation. And what you can say in 6 seconds is a lot less than you can say in 15. So it'll be interesting to see how that evolves. I, for one, the purest nature of Instagram,
yeah,
was really appealing. Really appealing. So I'm a little, you know, interested in how this is going to work out, especially because if it is as good as it needs to be eventually, it's not there yet. I mean, this is going to not attack Vine as much as it's going to attack YouTube. People have things to say on YouTube. Hmm. They go for longer forms. They don't put 15 seconds up there. But the idea that you have a forum now to get out a quick and dirty thing with very little editing, very little anything else, I mean, that's powerful. That's a powerful thing. And that gets away from some of the more frivolous stuff that would show up on YouTube. Right now, Vine to me feels like an exceptionally long animated GIF with audio. 15 seconds could be something very, very different. So I feel like this is a very wait and see move.
Yeah, I think it really helps that they've tied it all together in, you know, within their single platform, therefore making it, you know, very easy for a user to switch from video to photo. And just really, that's kind of one of the things that I think Google has prided itself in, mm-hmm. and has had allowed to make that company as successful as it's been, just that easy workflow. I think it's a great move by Facebook. Now it's all about execution.
Yeah. Yeah. And what is this, do you think this means for Vine?
It's hard to say. I mean, on one hand, Vine right now, Vine does have its core user base, and I think it all really depends on how well Facebook leverages their integration. As far as, you know, what Dwayne was saying is, so far there's a lot of issues, so that, of course, is going to detract them for a bit. I don't know. Vine sits at this weird place for me. It's not a utility I use. I know a few people who muddle around with it, but no. It doesn't seem like it has quite as lasting impact as something like, you know, Twitter or even Facebook. It seems like
it's designed to not be sticky. It's designed to be really frivolous because it's 6 seconds long, and that's why it has that animated GIF feeling. And I really feel as if Vine is hitting a different audience. Now, the problem with Vine is that it came out of Twitter. It's slightly more obscure.
Instagram's users are hardcore about Instagram, and what they've really done when it comes to Vine is simply limit those people from migrating to Vine for video and using Instagram for video for pictures, because that was like the natural divide I think we'd all seen. Now there's Viggle, and there are a few other guys out there who've been trying to be Instagram for video for some time. Instagram's also cut those guys off at the knees. So while yes, it ostensibly appears to attack Vine, it's really cutting off the guys on the knees who tried to come at this angle from before, Instagram for video, Viggle, that kind of thing. And it really, I think, begins to take people away from doing smaller things on YouTube. And so that's going to leave YouTube in a position where it's going to sit in between these things and Vimeo. You know, I mean, YouTube runs the gamut. It's got more videos than anyone. But if you can do a 15-second haul video, you're going to do a 15-second haul video. If you're an Instagram user and you like Instagram, you're not going to create a Vine account. And the fact is, with a 15-second limit, you can still make a 6-second video.
Yeah. Some people theorized that 15 seconds, they chose 15 seconds because it's a perfect length for a commercial, as opposed to, you know, it's hard to kind of get 6 seconds of information in a Vine video, but 15 seconds is perfect for like a little interstitial commercial, and that perhaps that Instagram will be leveraging this with their with some of their commercial accounts later.
Yeah, 15 seconds is enough time to have advertisers get a message across, definitely. So that's a good point that really works. So I mean, we'll just have to see. I don't know if there's a the story is that it launched. I think there's not much story after that.
So moving on here, the Federal Aviation Administration is expected to relax the ban on devices that now need to be completely shut off before a flight takes off or lands. Passengers currently must turn those gadgets off below 10,000 feet. Under the new rules being considered, cell phones would still be off limits, but other devices such as e-readers would be permitted for use during the entire flight. In previewing the rule changes, the FAA also announced it was pushing back the deadline for its recommendations to September. And Dwayne, you linked a story noting that that these changes won't change the minds of travelers who have been ditching flying and driving for riding the train and bus for years and using the Wi-Fi on trains and buses.
Yeah, I mean, if you have to travel, you know, any distance that's more than a 4 or 5 hour drive, you have a couple choices. You know, let's look at a 5 hour drive. That's New York to Boston, right? That's you know, New York to DC in traffic. Mm-hmm. So there are alternatives there, and those alternatives free you from having to be behind the wheel. Since those drives, those Eastern Seaboard, you know, corridor drives are not necessarily you know, mind altering, like automotive experiences. So you can get in things like the Bolt bus, or you know, Greyhound has some stuff, and you know, there's always Peter Pan in New England. But you can also get on a bullet train these days. Well, I'm calling it bullet train, but like the Acela Express and other things like that. Oh. And those guys have the advantage of being taken from A to B and not having to, you know, actually like maneuver the vehicle, and giving you relatively cheap access to connectivity. Now, I think there are kind of some different issues here. Connectivity is different from having your device available to you. I use an iPad in the plane. I read comic books off of it from Comixology. And it is annoying to, you know, not be able to read it. I also like to, you know, read the Engadget magazine or some other things that I have on there. It's annoying not to be able to read it. Once we get up, I turn it back on. I do my reading. I might watch a movie or something, whatever, on my iPad. But the fact is, I'm not connected. And I've made a choice not to be connected. You know, there's GoGo in-flight. There are a couple other options. I guess the article is really saying was that there are people who are like, I'd rather not fly and be connected. And I think there are a few things there. And one of the big ones is flying is – it's a pain in the butt. Not just because of that issue with the device, but because of you know, taking out your laptop, taking off your shoes, going through security. You know, you have to get to the plane an hour in advance. You don't have to get to the train an hour in advance. Now, arguably, a train is as dangerous as a plane when it comes to the amount of people locked up in one little area and what could happen if that thing explodes or something nefarious occurs on it. But right now, that's the way to go if you're going on these sort of shorter excursions and you get your connectivity to boot. So the fact that these FAA regulations are changing, they're not going to affect people for these short flights. They're going to affect people like me who are constantly flying to the coasts for business or for pleasure and want to be able to maintain, want to be able to get on the plane, sit down, take a look at my device, and just continue going. But yeah, I don't know. I feel like this is definitely a step in the right direction. I get that the FAA is slow to move, but it's always been kind of silly. So we'll see what happens.
Enough time has passed since 9/11.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, it's the advent of the electronic devices thing really has to do with the advent of like the personal computer being in the lap and eventually like embedded devices like the iPhone, the iPad, the Android devices. You know, these tablets and smartphones in general have a lot to offer aside from their phone connectivity. And so I remember back in 2006, 2007, I'd be on the phone with a BlackBerry. I'd be on the plane with the BlackBerry, and I use that as my music experience. And, you know, that was annoying to not be able to listen to your music. Just, you know, keep your headphones in, keep your head down. And, you know, there is something to be said about turning that stuff off under 10,000 feet. A plane's takeoff and landing are the most dangerous parts during your flight. So the idea that, like, something could happen and people have headphones in and they're not actually paying attention to what's going on, or they're not addressable because this loudspeaker goes on, but you don't really hear it. You don't really pay attention because you're into a video game or some music or whatever. There is a legitimate concern there. And I feel like that should be more of an issue than the idea that some tiny little radio waves are going to screw up your plane.
Right, right. Okay, I'm moving on here. Pink Floyd members Roger Waters, Dave Gilmour, and Nick Mason write in USA Today about how internet companies, radio companies such as Pandora, are trying to trick artists into supporting their own pay cut. They say nearly 90% of the artists who get a check for digital play receive less than $5,000 a year. They cannot afford the 85% pay cut that Pandora has asked Congress to impose on the music community. Last year, we joined over 130 bands and artists to oppose Pandora's campaign to stop to cut the royalties paid for digital radio spins. Widespread artist opposition stopped them last year, so this year Pandora is trying to enlist artist support for the next attempt at passing this unfair legislation. Musicians around the country are getting emails from Pandora, even directly from the company's founder, Tim Westergren, asking them to be, quote, be part of a conversation about the music business and sign a simple, quote, letter of support for internet radio. Sounds good. Who wouldn't want to be part of a conversation? Who doesn't support internet radio? What Scrooge would refuse to sign such a positive pro-music statement? Of course, this letter doesn't say anything about an 85% artist pay cut. That would probably turn off most musicians who might consider signing on. All it says about royalties is, quote, we are all fervent advocates for the fair treatment of artists, end quote. And the only hint of Pandora's real agenda is the innocent-sounding line, we are also fervent supporters of internet radio and want more than anything for it to grow. The petition doesn't mention that Pandora is pushing the growth of its business directly at the expense of artists' paychecks. So,
yeah.
What do you think about this?
It's pretty poor taste by them trying to leverage the same people they're trying to cut out of a piece of the pie, assuming that our interpretation is correct.
That's a
very sad move to make. That's a move you would expect from the record industry,
right? Isn't this the digital radio companies were invented for, to disrupt what the labels were doing, that relationship the labels had with
No. Okay, let's like put this in perspective.
All right.
No company was made to disrupt. It wasn't there to disrupt any company. Every company's out for money. Money, money, money. They want money in any way they can. If they can offer convenience to you and get you to do it, make me spend $36 a year, then so be it. That's what I'm going to do. But the big difference here is that when it comes to what is going on with Pandora and just any other digital, you know, audio company, Pandora, yeah, whether it's Pandora or iTunes Radio or Batanga or whatever, these guys are focused on getting content for as cheap as possible and having advertisers pay. Now, Pandora, most recently, they purchased a radio station, a normal radio station. Why? Because now they qualify for the same rights that a normal radio station qualifies, which right, is diminished return, diminished costs for, you know, media and support and other things, and being able to join the RAB properly and things like that. Radio advertising, you know, broadcasters, that kind of thing. Radio Association of Broadcasters. So, you know, these guys are pivoting as Pandora would pivot now that they have, you know, their investment, now that they've got a name for themselves, and they're pivoting in a way to get the most out of those investments and get the most revenue, period. And if there are laws they can lean on to increase their profit, increase their revenue, if not their profit, they're going to do that. So I feel like that's the thing. They're not here to disrupt radio and be the good guys. You know, the whole do no evil thing, that's Google. And people debate on whether or not Google's actually fulfilling that. They're here to make money, and they're going to try to use whatever they can to deliver the cheapest possible experience to the listeners. And that means, you know, like Sirius charges people, you know, 12, 14, 15 bucks a month, depending on the package. So Pandora charges people 36 bucks a year, or 48 if you go through the Apple devices. So they're trying to keep that cost down, or just keep people coming to them, because they have something like 70 million users. So I don't know, as a geek who's a fan of the, you know, the Music Genome Project, the way that Pandora organizes music, right, and like exposes me to music, right, and stuff, it's disheartening to think, oh man. But if you think about it, Pandora is in many ways primarily a music discovery tool, and as much as it's been around and it's been being disruptive, frankly, Spotify may even disrupt Pandora.
Yeah.
Even though it has a much higher fee, Spotify is 10 bucks a month, 11 bucks a month, whatever. That's a fee that is probably giving more money to the people who write and record these songs. But it's tends to be targeted, I would think, for a person who considers himself more of a connoisseur or aficionado of music, someone who's like about music in a way that Pandora's casual listening profile doesn't cover. So I think these are in many ways growing pains for an industry that's changing pretty rapidly. To be honest, people still overwhelmingly listen to broadcast radio. They listen to radio coming over the airwaves in their car.
It's interesting. I haven't listened to broadcast radio in years, seriously, and Spotify is now the major source of my music.
And are you paying for Spotify?
I am paying for Spotify.
Yes. Spotify it's got the power of being able to take a song that you don't necessarily own, download it to your system. The music discovery is tight. You know,
yeah,
it's kind of like how the Apple TV is a realization of the web TV idea. Spotify is in many ways a realization of the Rhapsody idea, which was around for long before that, but wasn't able to gain the kind of traction it seems that Spotify has been able to gain. I feel like Spotify is in many ways disrupting Pandora. Yeah, broadcast radio is still very, very popular. Now, the numbers around broadcast radio come from Arbitron, and it's very difficult to tell how real those numbers are because there's no true way to track radio. And there's technologies coming out that are trying to figure that out and the kind of thing. But for the most part, Pandora is disruptive. Then you've got sort of Batanga, which is much like Pandora, mm-hmm, but it doesn't have as many advertisers or advertisements, less rules about skipping things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, I don't know. I feel like I want Pandora to succeed. I just want to make sure that people are aware that in order to succeed, it's going to do some things that may come across as not PR friendly, but are perfectly within their rights as a company that's obeying law.
Sure, sure. It's just a shame. I stopped using Pandora a while back because I wasn't happy about the lack of choice. And with Spotify,
did you pay for Pandora?
I didn't pay for Pandora.
But you pay for Spotify.
I pay for Spotify.
So did you think that maybe if you pay for Pandora, you get a little bit more choice?
No, because Pandora still, it's still, you can't just call up a playlist of songs that you want to hear. You're still sort of subject to the discovery factor of Pandora. As amazingly accurate as that algorithm is, with Spotify, I can literally pick any songs that I want to hear as long as they have it in their library and create a playlist, whatever, and hear the songs that I want.
Sure. So you're approaching it from an iTunes perspective.
Yes.
You're not approaching it from a radio perspective.
Sure. Sure.
And what Pandora is, internet radio. That's sure. how they build themselves. They're, you know, like you can find what you want in terms of the type of music you like, but it is not a song for song ratio.
Right. And actually,
it's never meant to be. It's never supposed to be.
Spotify now has that radio functionality in their system as well. Mm-hmm. So Barnes & Noble announced that they will no longer manufacture color Android-based tablets and instead focus on their core business of e-readers. Amazon came out with the Kindle Fire at a time when the iPad was really the only successful competitor in the tablet space. Today we see low-cost Android tablets all over the place, including $99 models available at Walmart. And Barnes & Noble's financial results show that it's tough to compete in the market with the Nook HD and the HD Plus. They stated that they do plan to work in partnership with third-party manufacturers to co-brand color tablets. In addition to being the first ebook company to launch a color reader / tablet device, a lot of Amazon's success is due to their media and shopping ecosystem, which the Nook really never had. So Barnes & Noble's out of the Nook game, out of the Nook game as far as hardware goes.
Yeah, I mean, this was something that was almost surprising, not really. So what Amazon and Barnes & Noble both had going for them was that they both sold video and audio and literary and periodicals. The thing is, Amazon pivoted to sell these things in a streaming fashion several years ago. And Barnes & Noble never really looked into that. They focused on the books. Whereas I think that when you think about Amazon, you don't think about books as much anymore. And to me, the fact that those Nook tablets never really allowed me to watch Barnes & Noble purchases, or there was no place to purchase Barnes & Noble stuff digitally and watch it, was a mistake. They could have begun their own sort of streaming service. They already had some relationships with vendors, with labels and distributors of music and movies. And the fact that digital sales never really popped up, with the exception of books, was disheartening. And because of that, the ecosystem that you mentioned never took root.
Right.
And that's, I think, why these devices, these rich multimedia devices or rich media devices or whatever you want to call them, are no longer worth their time. They have to stick with the e-readers. And will the e-readers succeed? Let's face it. If you can spend $100 or something on a legacy Kindle Fire, yeah, and get to your movies and get to your music and get to your reader, you're going to want to do that. Now, if you're a person who likes to read to the point to exclusion, you like the sort of dedication of a dedicated e-reader, which is there are people out there, and I think that that's worth it, especially because the battery life is better and things like that. No distractions, no push notifications, a lot of stuff. Then they have a chance with those guys. But that's a small piece of the market that Amazon's going for. So Amazon can afford to lose money in that market just a little bit when they make risky choices. And Barnes & Noble won't be able to do that. So I think in the long run, we'll see the innovation on the Barnes & Noble side lose out to the amount of risks that you can take on the Amazon side. So it looks to me like the beginning of the end of their electronic business.
Right, Right.
Yeah, and I think they also joined in a little too late, too, in the whole tablet market.
The first Nook Color was the only alternative to the iPad if you wanted a tablet, and it was cheap. It just hadn't been meant to a tablet, so you had to sort of hack it. You had to root it in order to get raw Android on it, but it was an Android-based device, and people used that thing. It was like $150 for a while, and it was slower than an iPad, to be sure, but it was fast enough to get things done.
I guess it just feels like first the step of rooting really means that the only base you're getting is only the technological passionate person who's going to take the time to make that change, to transform the hardware, rather than having it just work straight out of the box. And I just feel like their place was just heavily dominated, and their devices couldn't compete on all levels compared to, you know, what Amazon had out, what Apple had out, and you know, what Google eventually put out.
Yeah,
right.
The others just had a greater sort of ecosystem behind them, backing them, than Barnes & Noble. But there we go. You know, all good things must come to an end. Speaking of Apple, Apple has added two major new content sources to Apple TV via HBO Go and Watch ESPN integration. The new streaming services add a considerable selection of content to the company's streaming content device, bringing the HBO Go library to the platform, which offers HBO's entire content library to cable subscribers who have the channel as part of their TV package. Apple's also added three new content partners, including Sky News, Crunchyroll, and Kello to Apple TV at the same time, which brings some prime international content to the platform from the UK, Ireland, Japan, and other parts of Asia. So Apple finally has HBO Go for HBO subscribers. That's good news. It doesn't affect me at all because I don't have an Apple TV, but I'm glad that
it's available. I have an Apple TV, and this is interesting. Like, you have to confirm, obviously, your TV provider.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to have a cable subscription. You can't just pay this a la carte yet.
Yes.
But I think a big piece of this shows that the cable box as a paradigm really is moving, because the Apple TV is incredibly inexpensive for such a popular device.
Yeah.
And it now you can get content from HBO, from your own libraries, from Apple, from Netflix. You get all this stuff, right? And that stuff is now available to you on one device with a pretty simple interface. Now, the whole Sky News thing, that's pretty exciting. It's a little sad that, well, not sad, but it leaves me wondering when either the BBC or BBC America shows up, so you can get your hands on shows that would otherwise show up on Netflix later. But I mean, this is the beginning of something different. This is the beginning of a kind of a true attack on the Roku.
Yeah.
I think the Apple TV was long. I mean, obviously Apple called it a hobby. Steve Jobs called it a hobby. It had podcasts and your photo stream and, you know, some Wall Street Journal. Now you're seeing, you know, Flickr, but now you're seeing content from the big dogs. So I feel like this is kind of a big deal.
Well, I'd say closer on par with the Roku, because Roku already had these stations, right?
Right. So I'm saying now it's moving into the Roku territory, where people had compared it to the Roku before, and it wasn't really a Roku alternative. If you had the Roku and you were getting the content out of the Roku, there was just no way to compete with there's no way for the Apple TV to compete with it. Now it begins that journey, and the fact is Apple's reach and their fan base is big. There's also one other thing that they added recently, and that's the Apple events. So now people who are fans of Apple can go, or people who might be curious, can click on that and see things like live WWDC, you know, September 2012's talk about the iPhone 5, WWDC 2012, and so on and so forth. So people can now explore Apple through the Apple TV, what they've done, when they've done it. And that's a big deal, because Google runs a stream of its I/O conference live for the world to see as it happens. Apple did that for WWDC, but really before that, they only did the iPad debut, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I think what we're seeing is Apple basically saying, look, we are content too. Look at us. We can entertain you with what we're doing.
Right.
Learn more about us and here, have access to, you know, I mean, these are, they now have top drawer content, you know.
Do you still think that Apple TV is, do you still think that Apple still considers Apple TV just a hobby, or is this really sort of like their Trojan horse into the Apple TV that Steve Jobs had hinted at that was going to revolutionize television?
I would say that the current Apple TV is not a core focus of Apple. And to use the word hobby is maybe a little of an understatement,
mm-hmm.
but it is certainly something that the iOS team is not focused on. And, you know, we've seen iOS 7, the iPad version beta just came out. It's clear that the iOS version on the Apple TV is a 6 variant, and it's unclear whether or not it'll ever be anything but that until they come out with a new piece of hardware that does, different stuff, has different capabilities, etc. So is it a hobby in the traditional sense of a hobby? No, it's making the money, whatever. But I don't think this is a core focus of theirs. They're focused on, you know, obviously they spend a lot of R&D on the Mac Pro. The MacBook Pros are probably going to be coming out with Thunderbolt 2.0 and some new chips. The MacBook Air, they changed the game again with this crazy sort of 12-hour battery life situation that they're claiming that they have in the new devices. So I think that their focus isn't here. And because of that, they can refer to it as a hobby. Whereas Roku, clearly that's their business model, which is why they have a device that allows you to do stuff like search across every single bit of content available on Roku or that you're connected to. And that's an incredibly powerful feature. Apple doesn't like to speak about their products in ways... They like to speak about their products in detail unless their products are kicking everybody else's ass.
Right.
And that means that in this time, in this space, the Roku is, you know... They don't want to, like, they spoke about Android and how, like, users don't buy things, or they talk about how, you know, other people's tablets stink or whatever. They can't do that on the Apple TV yet. And until they can, they'll call it a hobby.
Yeah.
Do you guys remember the name of that new device that's supposed to be coming out to allow you to basically competes in the same market but is more like a touch device or a motion device, depending on how you move your hands.
You're not talking about the Leap, are you?
No, not talking about the Leap, but this was specifically for TV. I'll try and see if I can find it.
Is it that ring that you wear that you put the ring on and it's like a remote control, but also moving your hands?
No, this was specifically like basically a set-top box.
I don't remember what that is.
I'll see if I can find it.
We have one last headline here to talk about before we get into our viral video of the week, and that is with Google Reader's demise looming, a host of media companies have jumped in to fill the impending void. And now AOL joins the fray with its own AOL reader, officially launching this week. Just like the just-announced Dig Reader and Google Reader before it, AOL Reader has a simple, minimalist design. Searching for news sources and adding feeds is straightforward. Just tap the plus sign on the upper left of the interface. A settings button next to that gives you more options, like the ability to import the OPML file for existing subscriptions if you currently use another reader. I have not checked this out. I have moved away from feed readers, and I don't use them as much as I did a few years ago.
So what do you use to aggregate the content that you want? I mean, you just use a social feed like Twitter? Or...
I totally do. That's exactly what I use, Twitter. When I was doing... social news curation on Dig and Reddit, I lived by feed readers. I would put all of my favorite feeds in there and comb through them and get the best articles and post them to Reddit and Dig. But since I've stopped doing that, I totally rely on Facebook and Twitter for and Tumblr in some cases for discovery of new news. And I find that with Twitter and Facebook in particular, it's fairly effective and fairly timely.
I mean, the thing about Twitter and Facebook is that what you're seeing is, like, there's nowhere to click to just show me news. I got to look at everybody's cat photos and all this other crap before I can get to my news. A newsreader's job is to show you news, right? Sure. So, like, sure. Google Plus, they're like, well, you know, we want you to meander. Why do they want you to meander? Because meandering allows them to show you advertising, and advertising is what pays the bills. Readers are simply too efficient for this day and age when it comes to people like Facebook, Twitter, and Google. And that's a shame because people should be able to access the news. So I don't know. I'm an Instapaper fan. I like that. I do use Reader, R-E-E-D-E-R, mm-hmm. on an iPhone and iPad. And, you know, Feedly still works. So, I mean, I feel like there's good cause for these programs. This protocol RSS, I don't think it's dead. If you're looking for, I think that's a lot of hyperbole on the press's side. And if you're looking for news, that's where you get it. That's where you can aggregate and follow something, as opposed to waiting until your friend posts something or becoming a fan of a certain publication. Because that publication isn't going to show you everything on your feed. That publication has people actively working to show you the sorts of things that they think you may like on the feed, which keeps you from expanding, keeps you from being exposed to things you might otherwise not notice, or of seeing things that you would care about, but may not be congruent with what your online behavior has been. If there's one thing I've noticed about online behavioral targeting, it's that you don't live your life completely online. There's so much stuff you do offline that you will say, I want to look into something. So I lament the death of this protocol vis-a-vis Google. I mean, like, you could say, oh, you're a dinosaur, oh, this, all that. But the fact is, Google did what some companies do that isn't so great. They went out and they cornered the market, and they shut it down after they cornered it, right? Yeah. And yeah, they gave us a lot of warning, and yeah, they did all sorts of stuff like that. But I get that they're exiting, but they cornered the market, and they're running away. It's almost as if, you know, Yahoo cornered the market in Maps 10 years ago, MapQuest or whatever, or MapQuest cornered the market in Maps 10 years ago, and then they said, we're shutting it down. You know what I mean? Like, it's one thing to sunset something that isn't popular, mm-hmm. And like, Google will tell you it wasn't popular, people weren't using it, whatever. But it's nothing to say, you know, how expensive is it to run? What would be the cost if you said people, hey, Reader Now is going to cost $10 a year? You know?
Yeah. So from what I heard, these are options. From what I heard, as far as the usage for Reader,
yeah.
And Google side was very minimal, and they continually were pulling people from the actual project until it was, you know, literally one or two engineers at the most. And so it just, for them, I think for Google, they'd rather put those engineering hours and cost somewhere else. So.
I definitely heard those reports, and I think that's great. Yeah, you know, people aren't using it, so yeah, we're going to sunset it. I'm just saying that I didn't see a lot of transparency around, like, what would it cost to keep it open? Is that going to cost, you know, the users of it $10 a month, $10 a year, $50 a year? You know what I mean? Like, there wasn't this kind of, like, Google's known for, you know, taking care of the consumer, and there didn't seem to be that kind of discussion.
Hey, I was a Wave user, and that went away, so.
Yeah, I mean, I was a Wave user, too, so were Chris and Devendra, and the fact is we used it, but we also knew that when Wave showed up, Google invented Wave and Google sunset Wave. Google did not corner the market on Wave. I mean, they invented that market, and they were like, okay, it's really not being used, and there are real problems with it, and it's expensive.
Reader was not that. It was an existing protocol where they came in and they did what they always do. Hey, we found a better way to do this than everybody else. So you start using it and they're like, we're going to shut it down. And that's where I think people got upset. So that's where the backlash came from. Now, is it a small amount of vocal people? Very sure. Absolutely. But with the fall of, Dig.
Yeah.
And then, the need for Reader probably dropped a significant amount. I don't know how well Reddit's doing, but I think that the social media feeds have really done some stuff. Now, Feedly had to migrate, I feel like, to holding some of this stuff, to doing this kind of work, because it's getting harder and harder to get data off of social feeds, because those companies, Twitter and Facebook, they want their user activity to only be available on their site. So whatever, ecosystems change, the news system is changing. I'm just happy that the news companies continue to have RSS feeds.
Yeah, it may be a while before we see the end of that, but I think with new companies, as new companies emerge, some of those new companies will just stop offering, will not offer RSS feeds to begin with. So you'll see.
But there's no downside to it, which is what's so weird. Yeah. It doesn't cost anything to have an RSS feed.
True.
It only gets you more traffic so you can claim more users, so your advertisers pay more money. No. Like if you look at the economic aspect, the only real reason I see for Google to stop with the Reader was because they weren't making money off of it. Not the way that they could make money off of Google Plus.
Well, I mean, if you consider the cost of an engineer, that's technically losing money, right?
Well, again, you can charge people for it. You can pass that cost on to interested consumers, and they have enough people to cover a couple engineers. I mean, you would at least then see what it was really worth to the consumers that are complaining about it. If people are complaining and you're like, okay, well, this is going to cost you some money, and they're like, okay, never mind, then you're like, okay, forget it. We're going to get rid of it.
But yeah, I don't know if Google is really much into that business of initially charging consumers in that fashion. I just don't think it's their mantra.
It hasn't been something they've done in the past, but let's face it. If you're a consumer and you do like a product, find a way to pay for it, because if you don't, it's likely that it will go away.
That's true. Now, the question is, will this have any sort of resurgence for AOL? Yes, no, maybe?
I mean, AOL is a content network that's doing very, 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 very well. They're not looking at this as a sort of like, hey, get on my reading thing and then like get my CD and install AOL on your computer. No, they've got Engadget, they've got GDGT, they've got TechCrunch. Half the news that the geeks that'll be using their feed are going to be using is stuff that they produce anyhow. That's what AOL is. It's a content network now, right, not an ISP anymore.
Yep.
So, I think this can only help AOL. Again, their economic interest is in making sure that they can claim they have more readers, which means giving as many readers as possible a way to read their stuff. The more readers they say they have, the more people in their network, the more they can charge advertisers, they win. Google did not have that. And like you said, Google's not so interested in charging consumers directly because they're making money on a data play, so they can attack advertisers that way.
Also, I wanted to mention before we talk about the viral video that Tosin, you found the device that you were talking about before. It is the Fan TV, which is a spin-off physical device from the app that used to be called Fanhattan and is now called just Fan TV as well. And Fan TV, that app was sort of like the Can I Stream It .com or Can I Stream .it, where you plug in the name of a TV show or a movie and it gives you all of the streaming options available and links to them. And I think Fan TV, like they were, Fanhattan was secretly building this Fan TV behind the scenes as a way to, and their service, Fanhattan, was going to be essentially the operating system, the interface for this device.
Sounds like Boxy. Sounds a lot like Boxy and how they had the service, and then eventually they have the hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there is that. Obviously, this just goes to show the cord-cutting situation is still hot, is still live. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think one of their main, one of the main things that they were driving for with their product is just better usability, making things easier, making things all about motion and swipes that you now have on a lot of your tablets and various controls in terms of interacting and seeing what's on and seeing what is, you know, what's going to be on at a later time without having to do channel flipping, without having to pull up a separate guide. So I would suggest checking out their video if you get a chance. It seemed pretty interesting. I don't think it's not market ready just yet, but you never know.
We'll put a link to it in the show notes. All right, that's it for our headlines. Now the viral video that waited for 2 weeks. Now we can talk about it. So John McAfee has had no problems making headlines this year. After the founder of the McAfee software security company was believed to be a murder suspect in Belize, he hid out in the jungle, escaped to Guatemala, faked a heart attack, and returned to the United States. But he's not done being in the limelight. The 67-year-old software millionaire has published a YouTube video called How to Uninstall McAfee Antivirus, in which he instructs users on how to get rid of the software he invented over 25 years ago. After reading some McAfee software hate mail to the camera, he calls on his lab tech, Bartholomew, to help teach people to uninstall the program. But before finishing the instructions, which involves installing the McAfee Consumer Product Removal Tool, the tech is distracted by half-naked women and drugs. McAfee himself is shown drinking, smoking a cigarette, and snorting bath salts. Ultimately, McAfee blames the current owners of the company, which he hasn't worked at for since 1994. He says, 15 years ago, I had some beautiful software, and they took it over. I don't know what they did. He says, frantically, before taking out a gun and shooting the computer. This video is a whole bunch of batshit insane.
It's a PR hit. I mean, like,
PR for what? For him personally.
This, I mean, like, we're used to seeing decadent, dilettante females on reality TV, Real Housewives, Kim Kardashian and her sisters and all that stuff. He's trying to get the spotlight from that same insane behavior. Right?
But decadent. To what crazy end? Like, what is he trying to promote?
He wants publicity, just like those guys want publicity. Yeah. I mean, do you look at someone like Kim Kardashian and think, man, I want my daughter to be like her? No.
No.
Do you look at someone like John McAfee and say, man, I want my kid to be like him? No. You actually might say, I don't want him to be like how he is now, but how he used to be, not so bad.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know how he's doing in terms of his finances, whatever, but this certainly can't hurt. And in terms of remaining in the spotlight, having some sort of public support, making it so that it's harder and harder and harder for different jurisdictions to have any murder trial in their area, because people have been exposed to a crazy version of McAfee that might get in the way of their judgment when it comes to, you know, court. All these things, right? So there are reasons why he might go through here. And it's clear that, you know, this kind of thing is never an accident, always deliberate.
Interesting. Well, it's definitely seems deliberate, but to what end is what's confusing the heck out of me. Like, I cannot figure out what he was thinking. But who knows? Maybe we'll find out.
We're talking about it right now.
Yes. Yes. So ultimately he got his wish. we're keeping his name in the public eye.
Yeah, but who knows? Maybe he does receive a lot of McAfee spam. Wouldn't put it past people.
Yeah, I don't think most people know that he's not involved with the company anymore.
Right. Yeah. Maybe that's it. Maybe that's the secret message here, is to get people to understand that he no longer has anything to do with McAfee antivirus.
Yeah, and maybe, like, maybe this is what actually drove him over the ledge, these emails.
Yeah, I mean, also, the fact that he took out a gun and shot a computer, not really helping his image as a peace-loving citizen. So,
are you,
who's that?
Are you doing the dishes over there?
No, not at all.
He's watering his peace lily.
No, I just have to, like, put some water in my hands. But the bottom line is that McAfee, he...
he's not really bringing up his image as a
no.
as a guy who is not violent by having the half naked girls and the drugs and, you know, bath salts. Jeez, wow. I mean,
could do much worse.
Yeah.
All right, let's go around the table here, and I'll start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online when you're not here on the Drill Down?
Twitter.com/DwayneD. That's Twitter.com/DwayneD, D-W-A-Y-N-E-D. You can also check out everything I'm doing at flavors.me/DwayneD, and you can find me here on the Drill Down.
Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321. You can also find all my other ramblings at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
Very cool. As for myself, you can find me at mrbabyman.com, facebook.com, and twitter.com/mrbabyman. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on the Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. We really do want to hear from you. Tell us what you think about the show. Leave us a comment on iTunes as well if you like our show. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our wonderful audience by writing to sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of the Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.